Kim Stanley Robinson wrote the ultimate trilogy on colonizing Mars, but when it happens, he says, it won't be a moneymaker.
Nobody can make a profit in space. Everything that's on Mars, everything that's on the moon and the asteroids, is exactly the most common stuff that we have here.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. NASA and even Elon Musk are actively working toward colonizing Mars in the next 100 years or so. Science fiction has, of course, already imagined such a thing. One incredibly detailed version comes from Kim Stanley Robinson in his Mars trilogy written in the early 90s. He has been watching the current efforts with some interest. Robinson spoke to me from his home in Davis, California.
The first colonists on Mars, I now think, will be modeled kind of on Antarctica. So it'll be scientific crews and people who keep the infrastructure going. For a long time, it might be considered to be an exotic place where we don't need to change it. But as soon as people commit to living there for their entire lives, they're going to want to give the place an atmosphere to protect them from radiation.
The first book in the trilogy is so detailed in the story of colonization that almost reads like a history. Do you watch the conversations that are happening now around Mars colonization and think, you know, either you're welcome or I already wrote this or I can see how this is going to play out from here?
Well, I wrote my book based on the exploratory work of a group called the Mars Underground, a bunch of graduate students in planetology that were at first based at University of Colorado in Boulder. So I don't need to be thanked. I'm just, you know, the telephone operator that plugs in the various voices and then they speak. I am very interested in the current talk about Mars. It's actually very hard to land softly on Mars, and we only have about a 50% success rate with our robots. And also, since I wrote my Mars books, we've discovered that the surface is way more poisonous than we thought it was. So there are slower downers in the whole program of going to Mars that a lot of people, having read my books or else have the dream from some independent source, they don't want to acknowledge.
It seems our current environment, political environment and otherwise, suggests that companies will be a key part of colonizing other planets. What do you think are the dangers of that?
Oh, I think the dangers are of trivialization, that suddenly the other planets in space, instead of being a commons that all humans are interested in equally as a kind of scientific project of humanity, just turns into another, you know, source of profit and exploitation. It's crazy, and nobody likes it. People loved those first tiny little rovers on Mars because they were public projects and everybody had a stake in it. Now, that said, nobody can make a profit in space except for communication satellites in low Earth orbit. Everything that's on Mars, everything that's on the moon and the asteroids, is exactly the most common stuff that we have here. There's nothing valuable up there. It's all iron, aluminum, magnesium, dirt, stone, and it's stupendously expensive to go up there, get it, and bring it back down. So, again, this is a kind of a fantasy people have. One has to say that in late capitalism, you have to redistribute, you have to reinvest. Capital is not capital unless it's reinvested and it's making a profit. So places sitting on a gigantic surplus, like certain billionaires and China and other places, they need to reinvest. And if there's nothing that they deem worthy on Earth, you can always try the moon or cast that capital up into space and kick the can down the road in terms of having a problem of getting something useful out of it.
What are you working on now? I know you have a fairly recent book, New York 2140, which I hope you'll talk to us a little bit about. And anything new going on?
Oh, yes. I'm writing a novel in which China establishes a big base at the South Pole of the moon. And then the rest of the world, in shock, tries to catch up. But China has an awful lot of surplus capital and labor and expertise. And so they could do it like in about, you know, 5 years, and they very well might.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, our richest billionaires could also establish a base on the moon in about 5 years to 10 years. I've heard some people say it would only cost about $2 billion to do so.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we've been exploring actually on our show is this idea of technology being evenly distributed and whether, you know, how likely it in fact is that space exploration will become the province of the very rich and that, you know, the poor will be sort of left on Earth, which is part of the scenario even in the Mars trilogy, right?
Yep, it's true. The people who are sent to space are going to be a small group of people with expertise, mechanical engineering, astronaut type expertise. And so they'll be highly trained experts at first. And then maybe rich tourists will in space hotels might be some of the first guests in space. That's one scenario. But I do think that especially for Mars and for anything beyond a kind of a single one-off tourist hotel, it's going to be an international effort, and it's going to have a scientific basis where we're doing it for knowledge and we're doing it to understand better how to manage Earth as a planet. Because we're accidentally managers of Earth as a planet, and manage is even too strong of a word because we're not that good at it, and it takes a lot of physical force that we don't have.
In this event where it is a ultimately scientifically minded, like Antarctic exploration or the space station, do you think that there are rules that should exist for this sort of global behavior, like a sort of a space treaty?
There is the Outer Space Treaties written and signed in 1967 by the Soviet Union, the United States, and then many other nations. And it's based on the Antarctic Treaty of 1959. So, again, the two are similar. And again, in both places, there are problems with enforcing these treaties, international agreements. There is no sheriff. And no individual nation cares enough to call other nations on it when other nations break the treaty. So it's illegal, like, to fish for the Patagonian toothfish in Antarctic waters. Some nations have allowed their fishermen to go down and do it. Other nations have not called them on it or done anything about it because it just isn't important enough. So I would say these treaties are weak. And if ever the stakes got high, the treaties would collapse. But the stakes might not be high enough. It might be a place where scientific cooperation just goes on forever. Antarctica has, aside from a few infractions, has been a place where all the nations, even during the Cold War, cooperated with each other to do scientific work. And it was as if the scientists were saying on the side, look, our countries may be crazy and in a Cold War, et cetera, but we're doing science and we're going to declare this a utopian space where everybody gets along. So it's a great model. It's a science and the spaces where science kind of rules are a great alternative model to the kind of global economic space that we're usually in.
That was Kim Stanley Robinson, author of the Mars Trilogy and a new book called New York 2140. It's about a New York City flooded by rising sea levels, but still bustling away as the center of global commerce. We had a fascinating conversation about that book and how it's also an attempt to tackle the problems of the global financial system. That's all in our full conversation, in which we also touched on the rules around colonizing space and more of his thoughts on science versus corporate interests. That's all in our uncut interview, The Source Code, at marketplacetech.org. I'm Molly Wood. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.